Today's show will be on case 25 in the Ikigunroku. Case 25 is the master of Rengeho's staff. Mango's introduction. If the action of one's ki is not independent of one's degree of enlightenment, one falls into a sea of poison. If one's words do not astonish the crowd, one slips into the conventional. If you can distinguish black from white in the moment of a spark's being struck, and can tell life from death in the instant of a flash of lightning, then you will be able to command all quarters and stand firm like a thousand-fathom cliff. Who could ever be so? See the following. Main subject. The master of Rengeho Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? No one could answer, and he replied for them, because it is of no use in the course of life. And again he asked, after all, what will you do with it? And once again he said in their stead, taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulder, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains. Secho's verse. His eyes filled with sand, his ears filled with clay. Even among the thousand mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide and you will wonder where he's gone. This is day five of our five-day session, and I have to thank everybody for doing an amazing job. You know, we still have many hours of sitting left, and koans can be resolved in those hours. But this morning, people sat so well. You know, I lost track of the time on the first sit, and suddenly realized we had sat for 40 minutes, and that was my mistake. But everybody sat still through that whole period, and then we had a rather shorter sit, and then everybody sat so beautifully again on the third period. It's very challenging to sit like that without a break, but the, you know, the deep samadhi in this room was really like a miracle, really wonderful. And then, you know, people are coming in last night and this morning into the Dokusan room, and it's very clear that people are practicing wholeheartedly. And the responses are just wonderful. I mean, really wonderful. So thank you so much for making such a good effort. And as I say, in the hours remaining, a lot can be accomplished. But maybe I shouldn't put it like that. A lot can be accomplished. There was a book that sold very well, a Buddhism book that sold very well called After the Enlightenment, The Laundry. And it's a wonderful book. I don't know if you've ever read it, and it's probably worth reading. The idea that Buddhist practice is something that happens in a remote Tibetan valley, by monks, or Japanese. Japanese or Chinese monastery far from the noise and clatter of the city, that image we have. And we imagine a monastery as a place where, the monks, we had almost a full moon last night. And one can easily imagine all the monks coming out of the monastery at night looking up at the moon. The cicadas are chucking, you know, and I just sit there under the moon, or, you know, watch the moon's image in the water ripple ever so slightly with the passing breezes. You know, this is an image of a Buddhist life, right? And when people become monks or nuns, they're called home leavers, right? Anagarika. And home leaver is somebody who gives up her name or his name, shaves his head or her head, puts on monastic robes, and you know, no longer has a job in the traditional sense, you know, doesn't make money. You know, all of this contributes to this idea of enlightenment as this state of complete, like, transcendence of everyday life, you know. And in fact, in early Buddhism, there was some debate about what happens to people after their enlightenment. You know, there was definitely a time in early Buddhism's development when it was believed absolutely that after a complete enlightenment, after like a daikensho, after an enlightenment experience, the person who has that experience must absolutely remain in a monastic setting and or die, basically. You know, it's like one or the other. Those are your options. And later Buddhism, like Mahayana, questioned this and said, you know, after your enlightenment, you're not going to lose your enlightenment or lose your purity if you rub elbows with people in town. You know, that's not going to be a problem for you. Mahayana Buddhism has this idea of being more involved in the world. So, like in the 10 ox herding pictures, you know, if you know those very famous Zen pictures, that series of Indian paintings, you know, it begins by looking for the ox of enlightenment, right? And then finding the ox, but the ox is really the untamed mind, and trying to lead it with the rope. And the little boy trying to lead this ox is trying to pull it down the road, and the ox sees some water, and it goes off the road and drinks some water, and then the little boy pulls it a little bit more, and the ox takes a few more steps, and then it sees some green grass, and it snorts and drags the little boy over to the green grass, and he's tugging and tugging. And if you're working on breath perception meditation, or you're working on the Mukho, you know, you can feel like that little boy trying to drag that big, lumbering, lawless ox onto the road, right? And you're pulling and pulling, and it's like, get back to move, get back to the breath, you know, and the ox is just running wildly. So, you know, then finally the ox is tame, you know, becomes tame. This is the trained mind. And, you know, basically, the boy is able to ride the ox while he's playing the flute, right? You know, so eventually the series ends with the achievement of daikensho, or complete awakening, and that was symbolized with an enso, a round circle, see? And that's sort of, up to that point, is sort of an early Buddhist point of view, right? But actually, later Chinese artists later and Zen teachers later added another picture, which is going back to the marketplace with gift-bestowing hands. See, so you're after the enlightenment, you go back into the marketplace, and it shows Hotei with a bag of gifts for people, and he's, you know, this jolly chubby monk, and he's there to help, and he's walking through the village, his only concern to help to bring his enlightenment into the world of action. So that's a Mahayana view, right? A Mahayana view. You know, take it out of the monastery, take it into the street, right? And that is a wonderful, and take it into your life, right? Take it into your life. So in the we Vimala, the Vimalakirti Sutra, you know, the main character is a businessman. He's actually a financier, like a banker, Vimalakirti. But Vimalakirti is engaged in all kinds of, you know, worldly pursuits, but the sutra says he's deeply awakened, right? So he's another example of somebody bringing this into the world, right? This bringing this into the world. But it's complicated, right? It's complicated because, you know, there's enlightened mind and there's the world of the 10,000 things or the world of red dust. And how those fit together is really, it's like a razor's edge. How to fit those together is like a razor's edge, right? You know, I think that in some ways, this book, after the Enlightenment, the laundry was a good thing. Because it's taking down a few pegs. This idea that enlightenment is this total transcendence of all human concerns, right? So that, you know, the Buddha is this man who completely left behind all human concerns, and after that was totally untroubled by anything. But that's not the, you know, and the author, Jack Kornfield, says, you know, really, that's not what enlightenment is, and it's not what enlightenment is for. You know, and Kornfield says, you know, after you get enlightenment, now it's time to roll up your sleeves and do the laundry, or do the taxes, or mow the lawn, right? And that's kind of like the ox herding pictures, right? Like after the Enso, get out there and do something to help people. And I totally agree with that. And by the way, the Buddha did that too. You know, the Buddha didn't live after the Buddha's great enlightenment, according to the Sutra of the Noble Search. The Buddha had a great awakening experience, and it was so shattering, you know, so otherworldly. It was like such a shift of perspective, right? That he was speechless, and he decided, the sutra says, he realized mentally no one would understand this if I tried to communicate to them, right? What I have experienced. And by the way, you know, if you try to communicate what happens to you here in the Zendo and in the Dokusan room, when you go home, it's going to be impossible to communicate this to people who don't practice. You know, if you say to somebody, it's all a dream, right? You say, really, this is all a dream. You know, they'll just think you're dreaming, right? You're the one who's dreaming, you know? You get back to business, right? Get back to work. You know, there's groceries to buy. There's bills to pay, right? You're the dreaming one. This is not the dream. This is the reality. You know, so people won't necessarily understand, right, what we're up to. Because it is difficult to communicate to people. You know, every once in a while, you know, even people who don't meditate have a run-in with the fact that the way we live is artificial, right? So right now, yesterday I talked about the IPCC report. You know, we live in a world that's a collective dream. You know, so the things we live for are, you know, if you're in New Jersey, you're an average New Jersey person, you want a bigger house, you know, an even bigger house, even though 80% of the house is empty 80% of the time, right? You know, judging from the houses going up where I live, they have to be even bigger, you know. So you want a bigger house, you want, you know, a good income, you want preferably going up every year, you know, and so on. All of this is part of, you know, and so we're doing this, and we're going to Disneyland, or we're going to, you know, Aruba and so on. Meanwhile, you know, the sixth great extinction is unfolding, and we're heating the planet up to a perilous level, right? And it's like, well, yeah, it's like outside of our reality, right? And we keep it out there until something like, you know, Lake Mead dries up or something, and then we can begin to realize that our reality is not real. It takes a lot of pressure to show people that reality isn't real. You know, really, like, the Lake Mead is down like three quarters, right, which is like unheard of. And all those people who have, like, these wonderful green lawns in the middle of the desert are living a dream world, right? They're living in a dream world. But, you know, there's a collision with reality that's going to happen to them, and it will begin to dawn on people when they turn, put the sprinkler hose out, put the sprinkler out, turn on the water, and nothing happens, you know, that they've been living in a fantasy. But it's very difficult for people to see that. So when the Buddha had his Daikensho experience, you know, he thought there's no way people will be able to understand this. And the sutra says that a god appeared to the Buddha. You know, this is it. Like, Indian gods are not like biblical god, right? Indian gods are a dime a dozen, right? There's lots of gods out there. There's Chakra, he's the supreme god, or Brahma. And then, you know, there's all these sort of minor deities. And one of the minor deities is named Sahapati. But anyway, you know, the Buddha just has this thought, you know, there's no way people are going to understand Daikensho. And Sahapati shows up and says, wait, you know, not so fast. He said, the world is, this world is, lives in darkness. You know, this world lives in, humans live in a collective dream that they cannot free themselves from. And they suffer endlessly, often from their own, you know, from their own doing, right? You know. And you know, if you don't help, the world is lost. So the Buddha is so moved by what Sahapati says that he says, okay, I'll give it a try, right? I'll give it a try. And he goes back to his five companions, these five people who he had been meditating with, and he says, he's going back, and he runs into this guy he meditated with earlier. And he says to this man, guess what? You're not going to, you know, I have just broken through to complete enlightenment. And the sutra says, the guy says, yeah, sure, see you tomorrow, right? You know, like, doesn't believe it. So, you know, somebody just said, get out there and help humankind. And the first experience he has is with somebody who rebuffs him. And then he goes back to his five companions, and at first they're skeptical too, but then they realize, you know, he's gone through this deep psychological transformation, and they're persuaded. And then he sets off to help people. So, you know, it's also the case that, you know, in another sutra, you know, right up until the day he died, the Buddha was busy helping people. You know, he is supposed to, according to Buddhist scholarship, you know, the Buddha's only supposed to have slept for an hour a day, right? He would get up in the morning and meditate, and then he'd go out and beg for his food, like all the other monks and nuns doing their alms rounds. And then he would come back and basically instruct students. And then, you know, later he would be meeting with other people who were like lay students or lay followers and helping them with their problems. And then he would, you know, meditate again late at night. So the Buddha was constantly involved in helping people. In fact, you know, in the Sutra of the Mahaparinibbana Sutra, the sutra that describes his death, you know, he's constantly giving talks to people and meeting with, you know, potentates and telling them, you know, don't go to war, you know, that's not going to work out for you, you're going to hurt people needlessly, and so on. So the Buddha was involved, not living up in the clouds. And so, you know, Jack Kornfield's book is a really great reminder that it's not about, like, someday I'll leave all this behind, never to return, right? But on the other hand, you know, it's very important to realize that the best thing about Zen and the best thing about enlightenment is that it is useless. This goes of no use. And, you know, for Americans, this is like waving a red flag at a bull, right? To say, I want to be if you're a young person and you go home to your parents and say, what's your goal? And you say, you know what my goal is? It's to be 100% useless. You know, your parents will have a heart attack, right? You know, and it seems like a totally immoral, you know, from an American standpoint, this is like immoral, right? You know, everybody should be gainfully employed and, you know, busy. And the idea of uselessness is like an anathema to people in our society. It's actually, it makes people mad. It makes people angry. And, you know, we can certainly, I mentioned the other day that wonderful woman I met, a wonderful woman, that doctor, retired pediatrician, you know, spends her retirement, you know, she could be in Aruba, she could be, you know, and instead she's going to homeless shelters and vaccinating people and going door to door to immigrant families and trying to persuade them to trust the vaccine, right? It's like, wow, you know, and she's busy helping, you know, so I totally agree, you know, I totally agree, but, you know, actually, it's very important to get people out of homeless shelters, and it's very important to vaccinate immigrants so that they don't get COVID and have debilitating diseases, right? Very important. But on the other hand, you know, on the other hand, you know, once we solve this problem, it's pretty certain that another problem is going to happen, right? So if you help all of these immigrant families by giving them COVID vaccinations, and you free them from the menace of COVID, you know, a certain number of those people are going to grow up and they're going to become drug dealers, maybe, right? Or they're going to get addicted to other substances, they're going to get substance addiction problems, right? Or maybe they will become, CEOs, and the CEOs wind up, you know, they'll become CEOs with big financial empires, and they'll wind up buying properties from poor people and driving them off their own land or something. I don't know if you see where this is going, but, you know, humans keep falling into trouble. They keep getting into trouble. You know, so it's like we're some humans are like people who climb out of, who don't see a ditch, fall into the ditch, climb out of the ditch, and then full speed ahead into the next ditch. And then they climb out of the ditch and they're full of optimism and they run forward and go into the next ditch. In a certain way, right, it's absolutely guaranteed that things tomorrow are going to be bad again in different ways. So it's possible to say that even if I take care of all these people who need injections, who need vaccination, they're just going to fall into another ditch tomorrow. See? So the reason that doctor is helping people, I think, is not because she's going to be successful at saving their lives, or that society will be a better place, or something like that. Because you know what? Even if she were told, if a God appeared to her and said, half the people you are saving are going to turn into going to be criminals, and the other half are going to be ruthless, I think she'd still do it. See? And it's not because society will be a better place. In fact, if a God appeared to her and said, society is not going to be better, she would still do it. And I think she would do it because she is full of compassion. Right? It's not about the result. It's about the compassion. See? Maybe I'm wrong. Feel free to reject everything I'm saying, But I think if she knew even that the world is going to be destroyed in 100 years, she would still spend all this time helping people. Because that's not the point. The point is to help in order to help. Because compassion, in a certain way, has no reason. It has no reason. It just arises spontaneously. And if it had a reason, actually it wouldn't be compassion, right? I hope I'm making some sense. There was a Greek philosopher I like, a socialist philosopher named Cornelius Castoriadis. And he talked about the fact that his grandparents in Greece, they were like 85 years old. And he said they spent a lot of their day planting olive trees. And he said they would never live to see those olive trees bear fruit. But they were busy every day planting those olive trees. And the other thing is, they didn't know whose olive trees they would be. So they weren't planting them like for their grandchildren, because their children lived in the city, and their grandchild was like teaching in France, They were, why were they doing this? It's like a gift. It's a gift. I'm just giving a gift. And if somebody says, what's the reason? It's not a real gift if there's a reason. So I think there's something wrong with saying, after the laundry, after enlightenment, there's the laundry. Like, the reason to practice Zen is because it will make you more successful, or it will make you better at what you do, or it will make you, well, for some, there's a reason or a result that makes this justified as something to do. See, I mean, this is what has driven me crazy about mindfulness meditation, right? I'm telling the truth, There are lots of corporate CEOs whose companies run mindfulness sessions for their employees. And they have all this research that shows that people do mindfulness meditation, they have fewer days, sick days, right? They show up to work more often, they are better workers because they're happy. and so on and so on. And, you know, I'm glad they're happy. I'm glad they're enjoying better mental health. But, you know, I can't help but feel that this is exploiting mindfulness meditation, right? You know, it's not really liberating people from the sources of their suffering, that is, their illusions. It's just taking them far enough down the road so that they won't, you know, initiate a strike action and paralyze the company. And, you know, mindfulness is, and I'm not knocking the ancient practice of Vipassana, right? But mindfulness in the United States has become like a tool in your tool bag, your life skills tool bag. You know, you have, another one is running, you know, like jogging. You know, lots of people jog because it cuts their stress. And I have done that in my own life, you know. Basically, you're jogging. You might say, I'm jogging because it keeps me in better health and cuts down on my stress. I can work extra hours. You know, if I go for a jog, I feel fresh. I can get back to the computer. That's not liberation, right? It's not, in my opinion. You know, I like to run because I like to run. You know, I like to run. I don't need a reason, actually. I certainly don't need a rationale or justification. You know, when I run, I feel connected to the world. I feel alive. And I feel better, happier. And, you know, I love to run outside, you know. So if it's a rainy day, I'm running in the rain. And my sneakers are wet, you know, and so on. And if it's a fall day, I'm running through the leaves, right? It's just so wonderful. And it may have these health benefits, but that's really not why I'm doing it. The health benefit is kind of like the excuse that people use, right? So I think there's something really priceless about the uselessness of meditation. The uselessness of meditation, right? And I think there's something degrading, actually, myself, about what has happened to Vipassana and to mindfulness meditation in America. It's turned into it's used to manipulate people, really, I would say. You know, you feel free to disagree. But, there's this, I've been reading these poems by this amazing poet, this amazing Zen master poet named Musō Sōsaki. And Musō Sōsaki is an astonishing poet. I have never read his poetry before. I read his Dharma discourses. But he has a poem about uselessness. And I just think it's so wonderful. It's translated as no precedent. Beyond any link with the world, he really is. To him, the Buddha and the patriarch's preaching is a waste of breath. He is gone now, leaving behind nothing, nothing at all. The great rock will never rest in the green Polonia branches. See, that's the ROC. This is a mythical bird. Right? So he says, this is a person, probably a monk, right, or a nun. You know, beyond any link with the world, he really is. And he's just like, he doesn't care about any of this, right? To him, even the preaching of the Buddha is a waste of breath. It's like, oh, it's a waste of breath. He has gone now, leaving behind nothing, nothing at all. This is like the great rock This is like this mythical bird, this great bird at rest in the green Paulownia branches, right? You know, the universe is 13.5 billion years old. And I think everyday people should ask themselves, did the universe labor for 13.5 billion years to produce a Big Mac? It's like, that's what evolution was all about. It was really just about a Big Mac, right? You know, was it really about the universe has labored for 13.5 billion years to produce a bigger house in Cherry Hill? And I think the answer is no, right? You know, I would say the answer is no. I think that that's small mind thinking. You know, and I think we're liberated, you know, when we suddenly realize, you know, that yes, we have to strive in the world. But, you know, whether I have a house of, you know, after the first 18,000 square feet, you know, it's all just a symbol, right? You know, in fact, you know, after the about 12,000 square feet, right, or whatever, 12, whatever. Most houses are unoccupied for 80% of the time, 80% of the house. So that's all just fantasy, right? You know, sometimes we free ourselves from all of that, and we realize this life is vast, the vastness that underlies us all. It is so amazing, right? So amazing. And that's what Musosokiseki is getting at. And not everybody likes poetry. You know, my wife is not a poetry fan. I'll say, this is an amazing poem. Listen to this. You know, I'm almost weeping. So what does it really mean anymore? You know, not everybody, people like prose, you know, some people like poetry. This is Soseki's The Buddha's Enlightenment. Hang on to your hats, because this is a great poem. For 6 years, sitting alone, still as a snake in a stalk of bamboo, with no family but the ice on the snow mountain. Last night, seeing the empty sky fly into pieces, he shook the morning star awake and kept it in his eyes. See, the Buddha had his enlightenment after 6 years of sitting still as a snake in a stalk of bamboo. And he was all alone, right? All alone. His only family was the snow, Soseki says, on the distant mountains. Right? And, you know, the Mahayana belief is that the Buddha had his enlightenment experience after meditating all night. And then in the morning, he went into deep mushin. And then in the morning, he saw the morning star. See? And when he went from emptiness back into the world of form, he had his great awakening experience. And Soseki says, you know, that the sky exploded, right, into stars, and he kept this, how does he put it so beautifully? The morning star, the sky flew into pieces. He shook the morning star awake and kept the morning star in his eyes, right? So that's his enlightenment. You know, when we do meditation, we go into deep mushin. Deep emptiness. And that's like saying to humankind, the Big Mac is not the achievement you think it is, right? The is, right? It's not that important. We're assigning all of that a value of zero. It's zero. You know, and then we come back into the world of form, right? And now we bring into the world of form that perspective. So we're not trapped in the world of form anymore, right? We're not trapped by those fantasies. We live in a collective fantasy, but we're not buying into it. We understand that it's not really real, right? And that our job is to help, but we know it's not really real. It's like a hard to walk that razor's edge, right? Because we're all conditioned to believe in the dream ourselves. You know, I don't know if you've ever had this happen, but, you know, there's times in my life where I've had, like, fever. And I have these dreams where I'm trying to solve this problem. And it's like I go this way and I can't solve it, and I go this way and I can't solve it. You know, this often when I'm sick, I'll have these dreams where, the problem doesn't really exist. It's just the experience of being trapped by a problem. And, you know, I wake up and I'm, like, covered with sweat, right, because I have a fever. You know, and that's, like, ordinary life, right? It's like we're going in this direction and that direction in a dream, right? And this happens and we're filled with terror, and this happens and we're filled with joy. And this happens and where we can't sleep for fear, right? And it matters. If you can't pay the rent, you're going to be on the street. That's a terrible thing, and that should not happen. But in another sense, you know, we can't really respond to all of that if we're overcome by terror. You know, when we can realize that this is all a dream, this is all fantasy, right? When we see actually the uselessness of all this, you know, then we have the chance to be helpful and to act freely without fear, without fear. You know, so the uselessness of meditation is our saving grace, right? It's because use is a human fantasy. Use is a fantasy. Usefulness, right? Purpose, meaning. You know, meaning is actually a fantasy, I would say. You know, Buddha says everything comes back to zero. Zero. So, we're not helping people because we want to cure, you know. Dentists fix your teeth, right? And if you have a cavity, they're really not into it because of fixing teeth, right? It's not really about cavities, right? It's really about helping people. And why help people? Because they're just going to die. There isn't a reason. You know, a dentist fixes teeth as an expression of his freedom and his wisdom, which have no ground. You know, I'm a teacher. I spend a lot of time teaching students. You know, 2 years from now, they will not remember my name. You know, and actually, you know, studies show that they don't remember what you taught them either. After 5 years, right? They did a study and a bunch of students did a macro and a micro, you know, a semester each, and they tested them right after, and they had like 80% retention. They tested them 5 years later, and it was down to like, unless they were economists, it was down to like 5%. And that doesn't mean everybody should, you know, quit their jobs. But what it does mean is that it's really not the point. You know, it's not, you're turning out, it's really, you know, what you're really imparting to people is how to live, right? Being kind is so important because it's groundless. There's no reason to be kind. There's no payback. There's no payback. And actually, there's no payback in life, right? And that's what makes it so amazing, right? It's like if you go out to the mountains, you know, why are you going to the mountains? You know, you're not going to get it. It's not a, and you can't put it on your resume. And I like hiking, right? You know, he has a PhD, but in you know, microbiology, but I'm a hiker, you know. Nobody's going to go, oh, that's very impressive, right? And yet, you know, it's hiking is one of the most amazing things, right? You go out in the mountains and you're liberated by the uselessness of it. I'll stop in 1 minute or close. I remember years ago they were going to build a telescope on this mountain in Arizona that was sacred to the Apache. The Apache said, please don't put that telescope on our sacred mountain, right? Because it's our sacred mountain. We wouldn't put a telescope on top of the Vatican, right? You know? You know, basically, I remember watching with great interest the testimony. And this Indian shaman, you know, basically, with a bandana tied around his head and a plaid shirt, you know, he testified and he said, look, you know, these mountains were not made for human foolishness. You know, and I think he was right. I think he was right. You know, these mountains were here long before we arrived, and they will be here long after we're gone. And the wisdom of mountains is that they have no purpose. And that's our wisdom too. What will we do with our purposelessness? What will we do with the meaninglessness of things? Because things don't have a meaning. You know? And when we experience that in the Buddhist way, it produces like enlightenment and compassion. Master of Rangehu Cottage held out his staff and said to his disciples, when in olden times a man reached the state of enlightenment, why did he not remain there? You know, there's no why, right? There's no why. No one could answer, and he replied for them, because it is of no use in the course of life. And again, the students are clueless, right? They're not ready to answer his question, so he answers for them. And then he asks again, after all, what will you do with your life, right? And again, he said, in their stead, he recites a poem. Taking no notice of others, throwing his staff over his shoulders, he goes straight ahead and journeys deep into the recesses of the 100,000 mountains, right? It's not about being approved of. It's not about, you know, it's about experiencing the pointless beauty of being alive. Sechos verse, his eyes filled with sand, his ears with clay, even among the 10,000 mountains he does not remain. Falling blossoms, flowing streams, he leaves no trace. Open your eyes wide and you'll wonder where he's gone.